Good evening. My name is Clara, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober tonight and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank Mike and the committee for the honor and the privilege to be asked to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. For me, it's always a privilege because I get one more day to celebrate life. And thank you for your warm hospitality. And it never fails when I get the opportunity to stand before you. I always feel the same feeling that I am standing in the sunlight of the Spirit. And this is a very special moment for me. I was born in Atlanta in Grady Hospital. And I'm standing here feeling as the prodigal daughters come home. And I grew up in Atlanta, and I went to school here, and I graduated from Booker T. Washington High School and started a journey from graduating from that school that's taken me to a lot of places and seen a lot of people and done a lot of things. And by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've come home to you, and I came home with dignity. And that's what you've given me in rooms like this in Alcoholics Anonymous. We tell our stories in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today. By the time I reached my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a winette. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, it describes the insane things that we continue to do to keep from doing step one and two. And it says we switch to natural wines. Man, I had switched to Ripple. That is not one of your natural wines. I don't think grapes have ever been near it. Yeah? But I also remember what I felt like when I sat in that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was April the 7th, 1974. And by the grace of God, from that meeting, I'm 20 years and 6 months sober a couple of days ago. And it hasn't been necessary for me to walk out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I sat there that night for the first time in my life, I felt safe. But it had been an incredible journey, and I had paid the price to sit there in that meeting. I believe that God had etched my name on the chair, and it was just simply sitting there waiting for me. By that time, I had drank away everything that was dear to me. And I believe that my alcoholism had affected the lives of every single person who had loved me. And I had drank away the career, the business, and all of those outside pleasures of life that were supposed to make me fit and be somebody. And I had drank my way straight to the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles, where that riot was a couple of years ago, with the drapes drawn, and I believe I was doomed to die of this disease. Sharing that little dirty cottage down in that ghetto with two children, my two younger children, my 8-year-old daughter and my 9.5-year-old son. And I always feel a feeling of shame after all of these years, and I get the opportunity to share my feelings of that I never had before, but because they had no choice but to go where a drunken mother had to take them, because you see, all of my fair weather friends had walked out of my life. And Bill Wilson, who's the co-founder of this program, that I believe was divinely inspired. And in his chapter, he talks about his fair weather friends. My usual position was not sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous until that night. But I was living down there on food stamps and welfare, the drapes drawn, sitting in a chair sometimes crying silent tears about broken dreams and unresolved relationships. And I would hear those children sleeping, And the loneliness was sometimes overpowering, and I was so lonely that I could feel the loneliness physically. And I would have to get up out of that chair and straighten up my red wig. And go off to the nearest sleazy bar in the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles, crawl up on a stool and wonder where all those other lonely people were coming from. Because I needed to have just that conversation after a couple of drinks with them. I would get quiet inside, and the tragedy of the yesterday and the fantasies of tomorrow would begin. And I'd be sitting there and with all the rest of the geniuses in South Central. By the end of the evening, we were all legends in our own heads. And I would imagine what would happen from time to time. I'm a real alcoholic. I had drank alcoholically for 27 years from that first drink. And I'm in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes a real alcoholic. And it was just the last part of that 27 years that I was in a lot of trouble and horrendous blackouts. I would probably go into a blackout and find my way back to that house. I don't know what it is about drunks that I could always seem to find my way home under any conditions. But there were several little steps in there from time to time. I'm sure that it was easier to pass out in the front yard than trying to make it up the steps. Those stairs didn't have railings and I didn't feel safe. So I would just kind of, you know, pass out in the front yard, face buried in the grass, looking as if the grass was growing up my nose. And I would jump to one of those blackouts and I could feel the quietness around me as if the world had come to a standstill and there was nobody on the planet but me. And I could hear my heart beating like a rapid drum. Sometimes as if my heart was going to explode. And if it was in the springtime or the summer, I could hear night birds calling to each other. And I, who was a non-believer in God, had come from the streets in the fast lanes of New York and Harlem and Boston. And I knew about making deals with God. And it was deal time, stretched out there in that wet grass. And I'd get really, really rational. I would just get out of control there some mornings, and I'd say, God, look, if you just get me off the ground this morning, the alcoholic prayer, you know, I'm never going to do this again. I'll even go to PTA meetings. And I haven't been, I'm 20 years sober, I haven't been to a PTA meeting yet, you know? Because what would happen is the phenomenon of craving would start. It's with the wonderful Dr. Silkworth, who gave to this fellowship the first step, that says we are powerless over alcohol, and the second half of the first step says our lives are unmanageable. And he talks about the phenomenon of craving of the alcoholic, and it would start. Dogs grow up in packs in the ghetto because they don't have owners, and they interbreed. And I was already into horrendous hallucinations. And I'm stretched out there, and from time to time, it'd be about 7 or 8 of those little dogs trucking by. And you know, they had those metal trash cans in those days. And they, everybody down in the ghetto, it's all about surviving. And, you know, with the interbreeding, I was lying out there one morning, and I saw this dog trucking by, and it had the face of a German police and little short legs. And I wasn't sure. If I'd seen what I'd seen. But I'd stagger up off the ground and I'd hear the dogs knocking the metal can into the streets and the lid began to roll. And first it would be with a lot of speed and then it would wobble down to quiet. And I'm standing in the yard trying to brush the dew off my shoulders and straighten up that wig and look around, see who's looking. Listen, nobody in South Central was cared about a drunk woman in the front yard at 3 and 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was always so dark. And it always seemed darkest right before dawn. There was a lady that lived across the street. I don't know, most neighborhoods might have ladies like that who appoint themselves as monitors of the neighborhood. Wish you had one in my neighborhood, and I don't think that woman ever slept. Anytime, day or night, I could look across there and see her little curtains moving back and forth. Now, after I get my cool look in the front yard, I give her the finger. Stumble up those steps. You know, I'd walk straight. You know, God forbid she should think I'm drunk. I get through that front door, I lean on that door, and oh God, was I sick, physically, emotionally, and spiritually dying. And I'd feel it coming. By that time, I was drinking all of my meals, and I'd charge down that hall and get to that bathroom and get on my knees in front of the toilet bowl, do a few chin-ups on the rim. That cold porcelain, oh, you know, the hour in the morning, my chin sliding around trying to find a comfortable place to rest. Then I'd pass out at the base of the toilet in that feeble position that had become my position. A dying person in the position of a little child. And I'd pass out again. And that's the way it was. And I'd come to, and the room would be spinning. I'd do little things to keep from the room to stop spinning so fast. And I would look at something, and the two words that always greeted me was American Standard. Stamped on the bottom of the toilet. I'd get up, break the promise. I always made the promise. Had told those kids the day before, no, Mama's not gonna go down to that liquor store. Tomorrow, Mama's gonna stop drinking. And I always in my heart believed that. You see, but by that time, you know, I was at that point where I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober and I couldn't stop drinking, and that's called madness. Standing in the dirty bathroom, feeling that craving and that sense that's flashing in my mind, and I'd have to get dressed to make the run. 65 pounds overweight from living off food stamps and welfare. Pull on those tight jeans, put on my bad leather jacket, shove on my dog glasses, and put on those starfire earrings that hung to my shoulders, and my mode of transportation by that time was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. Hear the scratching sound outside, and I talked about the paranoia, and you know, I always knew the enemy was out there. See, all my life, from 5 years old, from here in Atlanta, you know, I had always known that the enemy was out there. And I got the Alcoholics Anonymous by the grace of God and found out that the enemy was me. But I could hear that scratching noise in the ghetto. It's not about community, and it's not about cutting the grass and painting the houses and keeping up the property. And that house I lived in probably hadn't been painted for a number of years. There were a few little specks of white paint that just refused to peel off. So the wood was always wet at night in the California climate. And in the morning when the sun would come up and warm the wood, it had a scratching noise. I knew they were out there, but that nothing could stop me. I was willing to sell my soul for a drink. And I'd have to get past the door where those kids slept, tiptoe not to wake them up because of the guilt and the shame and what my life had come to. I didn't want to have them looking at me one more time in the morning. So I tiptoe past the door and get to the front door and open it quietly. Sneak down the steps like a thief in the night. Cross the street past three houses, get in front of the liquor store door. There's an approximately 6 to 7 liquor stores in the ghetto in one block, with little storefront churches sandwiched in between. It always amazed me, after I got sober, I never stumbled into one of those churches. I just would always stumble into those liquor stores. Leaning on the door, waiting for the man to come. Viewing the world out of my dark glasses like I always viewed the world. It was a hostile place to live in, and I had never known how to live in that world comfortably. Wondering what happened to those friends, the ones that I had wined and dined and bought all the love that I could afford. The one thing I learned out there in the streets, that love is for sale. And I used to sit in the jazz club, and I was, you know, I ended up in the jazz world, not performing, just hanging around them. And for many years, I was in that jazz world, in those great jazz clubs in the East. And I would just, you know, I didn't know what to do with the, you know, so I would just stand there and wait. Not one of them ever showed up on those dark, cold mornings and stood next to me and said, "Clara, how is your life today? And what are you going to do about it? And when are we going to lunch?" Instead, the guy would come, and I would stand there. I hated that guy. He had this big black Lincoln with white wall tires, and I had all those things. And I'm standing there waiting for him to come so I could buy some Ripple. With usually I had stolen the money from the kids. My brothers and sisters and their grandparents, you know, would give them money, and I would go with the hammer and beat the bank and get it out, because I needed it more than they did, but I always promised that I would pay them back. Trail into that liquor store and stand in front of the clerk early in that morning, you know, feeling of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Clerks are cruel sometimes in the ghetto early in the morning. They play games. I knew about the games of life, but I just had never known how to live it. You know, on a bad morning, and when I wasn't, you know, I was bouncing a lot, body feeling like a motor, really aching and really racked with pain, because I needed a drink just to calm down the pain. I used to try to give them a choice. I used to, you know, and talking about denial, I'd say to the guys, and some of them sometimes, as early in the morning, I said, "You know, well, this really isn't for me." I didn't want that guy to think that I was in there buying Ripple every morning like that. I said, "You know, I have house guests." Man, I hadn't had a guest in my house for a long time. And he'd say, "Yeah, yeah," and he'd hold it, you know, and take the top of the bag and just fool with it and want to talk. Now, if it was a bad morning, I'd just take it out of his hands and get out of his sight, past a little plate glass window, get on the side of the building. You know, my days for fine drinking had long been over. And I didn't have to worry about bottle openers and proper cocktail napkins and stirrers and crystal glasses and mood music. And the faces of smiling, handsome men. No more. All I had to do was unscrew the top off of that bottle and take a hit of it. And Dr. Silkworth says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. See, well, by that time, I wasn't drinking for the effect. I was just drinking to stay alive. Shuffle back to that house and sit in the overstuffed chair, watching the dawn really come up, probably feeling like the man who said I had a dream last night, that life was passing me by and I was no longer in the dreams of life. Hear those kids come out of that room and go into a kitchen and make their breakfast and make their lunch, and I'm sitting in an overstuffed chair, staring out of the window and watching the world come alive. And they go on off to school, and I'd sit there in that chair and wonder, how did I ever get from that place, growing up in Atlanta, Georgia, in a wonderful family, my parents were loving, and there were seven of us, and I'm the youngest of the seven children. The other six were born in Bainbridge. My mom was born in Bainbridge. My father was a full-blooded Cherokee Native American, born on a reservation in Cherokee, North Carolina, and had migrated to Georgia and had met my mom, and that's where they married and they started the family. And they moved to Atlanta so that one thing he wanted for his children was to have the best of education and the very best that life offered. My father was an entrepreneur. He had a business very successful over on Hunter Street. I don't know that it's still, that street is still there. But I lived about three blocks from Morehouse and was expected to go to Spelman. My father was an artist, and I was a loner. I'm one of the ones, and I'm the alcoholic. I don't know how that happened. You know, it seems that the rest of them got the message. And we were taught, and it was a very religious home, and I grew up in Union Baptist Church, and I was baptized in Union Baptist Church. And somehow I just didn't hear the message. I just never could hear the message. I couldn't hear the message about Christian values and moral values and family values and what it took to be comfortable in life. And it was about giving and not taking. You see, I was a taker. You know, the book talks about the alcoholic and the selfishness and the self-centeredness. I believe that I'm really one of the ones that was born restless, irritable, and discontented right out of the chute. You know, I had a hard time. You know, I'm really one of the ones, I became a bourbon drinker. I drank 101 proof bourbon on the rocks, and you know, a little bourbon on the rocks in the first grade over there at Ashby Street probably would have been a wonderful thing for me, you know, just to get me to the second grade, you know. I had a lot of trouble. I had a lot of trouble with the church, with the family, with the system, with the school, and I never felt like I belonged. When we talk about feelings, I was never aware that there was such a thing as a feeling until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. My life was always in the gray area. You know, I mean, my feeling of low self-worth and low self-esteem, and I always felt inadequate. And it didn't matter how good I looked on the outside. We really had it all. And I went into that school at Booker T. Washington High, and in my senior year, I was a loner. I was a loner. I was a loner who needed people. And in that school, I had no friends. I didn't know how to be a friend. And I've done a lot of inventories. And I have never found out why it was that I was so different from the rest of them. And it really doesn't matter today. My art teacher came to me and said to me, I think you have enough talent that we could apply for an art scholarship for you. And I said, why not? You know, I mean, I didn't believe anything good could ever happen to me. But so she sent off the information, and we got the reply from Boston that I had been accepted in the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And I remember the family taking me all gussied up with all the luggage and all the, I was always so angry. I never could communicate, but there was a part of me that was so happy that I was going to get out of the town, and I already was doing geographics, and I hadn't even had a drink. You know, when I grew up in Georgia, I believe, was a dry state. I had never seen alcohol. I'd never seen a person drink. I had no idea about alcohol or alcoholism. And when I sat on that train and it pulled out and got to Boston, and I walked into that school, and I knew right away I did not belong there either. I just never fit. And I looked at those students, and all they had such talent, and I read the art calendar today, and some of those then students are the foremost artists of our time. And they went their way, and I went my way, and I hope they're as happy as I am today, because I went off looking in a different direction. There was always a secret about me. When I grew up, Booker T. Washington High School, my parents would never let me take the subject that I wanted to take, which was performing arts and music. And the late great Graham Jackson was the music director at the school at that time, and my father told all of us girls that his daughters, that was the devil's work, and that we were ladies, and that we were Southern ladies, and we were never to go into that kind of field. And I always hated that, because I that's really what I wanted to do. And so I hung out in the movies a lot. I hooked school, and I hung out in the movies because it was dark and it was silent, and nobody had to ask me any questions. And I didn't have to let anybody know that I didn't know anything. And I didn't have to let them know how terrified I was on the inside, that I was never going to succeed, and I was never going to live up to those potentials they always told me I had. I didn't even know the meaning of the word. So I hung out in the movies and watched people up on the stage, because that's really where I wanted to be. I love jazz music, and I would hide in the closet, because I had that Baptist upbringing, and I have nothing against religion today. I read the chapter to the agnostic, and I have no problems with it today, but at the time I had a lot of problems with that. Every time they cracked that door over there at Union Baptist, they seemed like they had me on the front seat. And I just, those deacons prayed a lot over me, and I had no idea what I had done that they needed to do that much praying. But anyway, but I'd play these jazz records in the closet. It was at a time when if a lot of you like jazz, it was at the time when a lot of the great late jazz artists of the time were performing. And one night I was walking down the street with another student, and I heard this music. Some people walked out of the door, and I just said to this student friend, I said, "Let's go in there and see what they do," because I heard the music. We walk into this club, and I can still remember the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze, and it was dimly lit. And at the end of that bar was this rather heavy lady grinding out this low soul music. My heart started pumping, and that feeling of living on the edge. I walk up to this counter, and I sat on the stool, and the bartender leaned over with a Pepsi Dent smile. And he said, "What are you going to have to drink?" I had no idea. But I remember in the movies, they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip slick cool act. I leaned on that bar and I looked him in the eye and said, "We'll have a martini, honey." I said, "And make it dry." Had no idea what a dry martini was. He whirls around, he puts these two stem glasses up there, and he evened it out. It looked like lemonade. I remember drinking a lot of lemonade in Atlanta when I was growing up. I didn't know you sip drinks. So I pick it up, I look around, and I downed it. And I want to tell you the way it made me feel. I looked around that room, I who had never had any friends. I stepped off that bar with a glass in my hand, and all those fantasies came rushing forward that I'd been thinking about since I was a little kid. And I suddenly started calling my new friends. I just got real in a real fast hurry there, and I called them colorful, but the big book calls them lower companions. And I stayed out there so long, I became one of the lower companions. Because right away I hooked up with the pimps, the hookers, the madams, and the bad boys. And I learned to walk the walk and talk the talk. I learned real fast out in the streets. You know, I still love jazz, and there's my favorite jazz singer today is Randy Crawford, and she sings a song about street life. She said, "If you are young, don't get old in the streets, because the cold will hit you in the back and you nickel and dime your life away." And you look back one day, it was all a masquerade. Because what happens is you have to learn to be a role player. So I learned real fast with a glass in my hand how to play the role. And I didn't know playing that role was going to end up 27 years later in a field position in the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles. I never dreamed that that would happen to me, because those certainly were not my plans for life. What I have learned is life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. And it's true. That became a nightly thing. I'm sitting on those jazz, in those clubs night after night, and I made my little entourage, and I got hooked up with the entourage. I became an entourage addict with them. I would just hang out with them. I couldn't wait till the sun to go down for me to get out of that school. And by the end of that year, they kicked me out of the school. I lost that scholarship because I was having fun in the streets. I married a nice young man who came from a similar background, and he was a third generation Bostonian, and he came from a family that didn't drink, and we learned to drink together. And we got married and I stayed in that relationship for 24 years. I want to tell you, it was the sickest relationship that I think the two human beings could have been in. I sponsor a lot of women, and they come to me talking about relationships, and and they want to know about mine. I said, listen, you know, the way I can describe mine is the rocks in his head fit the hole in mine, you know. And so, we stayed in that marriage. We had a little son, and it was a beginning and I was drinking people under the table, and I was proud of my ability to drink the way I drank. And we had this little child, and it began to change my feelings. And I pushed him off on his grandparents to raise him because I was too busy. You see, I was busy hanging out with the likes of Charlie Parker and Dinah Washington and Billie Holiday, and I couldn't, it was too much of my time away from my lifestyle. I know the difference today between a lifestyle and a life, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I have a life today. You know, happy, joyous, and free, just like the books that promises us, and the promises are coming true in my life, just like it promises. But at the time, all I had to do was just to go over and see that little child. In my opinion, as he grew up, in my opinion, there is nothing sadder than to look into the eyes of a child when you can't tell them the truth. You see, and I get over there, and they get to that age where they start to look at you. It was too painful to watch him look at me, and he was so disappointed because I always lied to him. Because Dr. Silkworth says there comes a time for us that we can't differentiate the difference between the truth and the false. And I would always promise him to take him to the park next time. But Mom, he said, you promised me the last time. And I'd say, I know. But next time, darling, next time. And I'd have to get out of the sight of his eyes and get in that car and go back on that bar and crawl up on the stool. My ex-husband traveled a lot in the family business, and so I still hung out in the streets because that's where my friends were. And I always looked for Mr. Wonderful. I always looked for that man, that person that was going to be like my father, who never refused me anything. And I kept looking. If you look long enough, I guess they do show up if you hang out in those kind of places and wild parties and doing what you do. And I'm sitting on a bar stool in an after-hour place early one morning drinking with Billie Holiday. And we're chatting away. And Mr. Wonderful he came off the end of the bar. I mean, he just kind of eased up the bar. And he leaned in front of my face, and he had a black hat turned down all the way around. He had a top coat over his shoulders, and he was so cool he couldn't get his arms through the sleeves, you know. He closed one eye, and he reached in his pocket. He pulled out this wad of money, and he peeled off 10 $100 bills, and he put it down on the bar, and he spread it like a deck of cards, and he whispered, "Spend it." Lord, I knew that God had answered my prayer, and I love money, and I was off and running, and I was already into step two by that time, because Mr. Wonderful is what I named him, and he turned out to be the head of the mafia. of the New England family, and I'm suddenly riding in a limousine with bodyguards. And it was a lifestyle for a long time. And it seems to me that the God that I've come to believe in, from time to time as I took crossroads, I believe I always took the road that was self-destructive. I don't know what it was on the inside that just it wouldn't give me any peace. And the more money I spent in the gambling and the hanging out with the mob and in Providence and going to the family reunions, and I mean, it was awesome. And I was getting more and more away from the reality of life. And one Sunday morning, as we were being driven home in that limousine, it seems that a voice came to me. We in Alcoholics Anonymous call it a moment of clarity. And a voice quietly said to me, "Clara, something is wrong with your life." And I agreed. The problem was Boston. If you just get out of Boston, get away from these hooligans, start hanging out with the madams. And you know, my best friend was the king queen madam of the time, and she was from New Orleans, and she was a Creole with brown skin and green eyes, and she was a businesswoman, and I loved hanging out with her. And I thought, if I just get away from this, because I looked across the street and there were these young families with little kids about to cross the street into this beautiful New England church. And when I sat on that train, when it pulled out of Union, out of Terminal Station, I swore I would never put my foot in the church again, because there certainly was no God. And when I looked at that scene, I knew that I had to make a change. My son was 10 years old by that time and almost a total strange to me. I did what, you know, I always knew to do. You buy him off. Send him to a better camp, buy him more expensive clothes, and, you know, and make the promises that I never could keep. We picked him up and put him in the back of that car, and we drove out Route 66, and I came with good intentions to California. And I wanted to be a better mother. I was going to be a better wife. I was going to get my act together. I was going to go to those PTA meetings, and even if I had to drink tea and eat those cookies, you know, it was, you know, I thought, you know, because I looked at other women and their relationship with their children, and I wanted that. In my heart, I really wanted that. I just didn't know how to go get it. So I went to California with good intentions, and what I did is, I'm an alcoholic, crawled up on the nearest bar stool in the nearest jazz club. We got on with our lives. We went into a small business, a maintenance business and property management business that got successful. We had two other children in Los Angeles. The family had moved out from the East Coast. They'd all been exactly what our parents wanted them to be, successful in the field of education and business. And they all, you know, as I said earlier, they had gotten the message and they knew what life was all about. They moved out there and they loved California. But they began to watch my drinking, and I was beginning to accelerate into out-of-control drinking. The ex-husband, he was then an ex-husband because he had to leave because of my violent behavior under the influence of alcohol had started to happen, and we began to lose it all. I never dreamed that I'd stand in a meeting of alcoholics and say, "Thank you, God, that you took away from me everything that I wanted in order to give me what I needed." It had come that time in my life when I needed to get sober and I needed to find a God of my understanding, and I just simply needed to stop dying. Dying inside. I have a friend a couple of years ago that we'd become quite friendly in the 9 years that she was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she died of AIDS 2 years ago, and she'd been an intravenous drug user before she got sober, and it evolved 9 years later. And I remember going down to Redondo Beach, which is a beach town near Los Angeles, and sitting across from her, because I'd been always been, that was from 5 years old, my fear of death was overwhelming. And I sat there on an early Sunday morning, and I looked at her and I said, "How do you feel about death?" And she looked at me quietly and she said, "Death is not the greatest loss in life. The greatest loss is dying inside while you're still alive." And how many times I just simply died slowly inside, drinking and thinking. And there's nothing more painful than an alcoholic drinking and thinking and how you're going to get out of this. He left, and I was ending up in places where, because the Internal Revenue took the business, and I'm standing out front of the house, and the marshal putting the lock on my beautiful home and just taking it all away. That older son was 10 years older than the two younger ones. I was standing outside, and I had gone to my family one more time and to ask them to help me, and God was, I believe, working in my life through them. They finally said no. They stopped enabling me. They were about to enable me right to the cemetery. And that older sister who had become a nurse, she'd gone over to Chattanooga and had finished nurses training school in there, and the other sister had graduated from Payne College in Augusta, and I went to them to give me the money to save the house, and they said no. But the older sister looked at me and she said, "You know that look that people who love you, that look of hopelessness and helplessness, and when they tell you the truth and it's so painful you don't want to accept it," she said to me, "it pains us to watch you live the way you live, but we can't do anything else for you. And we're not going to sign any more checks." And I was furious. How dare they not rescue me one more time? And she said, "But we're going to pray for you." And I have come to believe in the power of prayer, because I believe it was their prayers that got me off that floor from a fetal position on April the 9th, 1974. But I turned on them and I stormed away, and I'm standing out front of that house with that older son and those two younger kids with a bag and no place to go. And that's how I got to the ghetto of South Central. Looked at that son, and he said, "Not me. I don't even know who you are." He said, "I'm not going to the ghetto with you." And he turned and walked out of my life, and I stood there watching him as he walked away. And I was screaming inside. I wish I could have been able to have said to him, "But you don't understand. If I knew better, I'd do better. I'm doing the best I can." I had no idea I was an alcoholic. I knew what was wrong. It was them. If they just shape up and get off my back, stop telling me I drink too much. But I picked up the bag and went down into that ghetto. It was, and you heard, you know, I've shared with you what went on in that ghetto. And one Sunday morning, one more time, about 3 weeks before, my miracle happened. I'm in the hospital. Paramedics, people who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. How many times did I sit in that overstuffed chair contemplating suicide, only to learn that suicide is a final solution to temporary problems? And I've learned the solution to those problems come in the form of 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I'm laying there and they're pumping my heart, and they're bumping it, and I jump to, and the police is at the foot of the bed, and there are two nuns standing next to the bed, an older nun, and she looked at me, and she wasn't thrilled with me at all, and because I was giving her a hard time about not cooperating with the police. I had grown up with an Indian father who said, "You don't tell the secrets, you don't cooperate with anybody." And I'd grown up with I hung out with the mafia for a number of years, and he said, "You better not tell the police." And so they turned and they left, but the young nun stood there as the older nun stormed out of the room. And I have come to believe in earth angels. They're real. And each and every one of us have one. All over the world there's an earth angel. Standing up beside that bed was a young nun about 23 years old, with a gray habit on, and all I could see was her face, and her eyes were as blue as the heavens. And I looked up at her, and tears were falling on the covering of the bed as she looked at me. She didn't say, "Why don't you stop drinking?" She said, "How did you ever let your life get into such a state?" What does she know my attitude was? She's in here, she doesn't know what it takes to be out there in that street just to survive. But I heard her. And as she looked down at my face, I had a In that blackout, out of that blackout, I had a brain concussion. My face looked like somebody had used it for a trampoline, and I could still hear my ribs being kicked out one at a time. Pair of black boots. I know about pain. I know about physical pain, and I know about emotional pain, and I know that pain has no memory. I stood up in the room. It was dark. The stench of stale wine was just a miracle that it hadn't been one of those mornings when some stranger was there that I had to find out what's your name. That's a demoralizing position that alcohol had brought me to. My life was only worth 59 cents for a glass of wine. And I stood up in the room. I heard myself say in a voice that was not mine, and I broke the promise I had made on the train going east that I would never pray again, and I heard myself say, God, please don't let me die. And as I stood there in that room, something happened. I guess I could relate to the story that Bill Wilson tells about his spiritual experience. When he called Dr. Silkworth, who was treating him for alcoholism, and Bill Wilson questioned his own sanity from having had that spiritual experience. And when he shared it with Dr. Silkworth, Dr. Silkworth, who was not an alcoholic, said, well, I don't know what's happened to you, but hang on to it because it's better than what you had before. And Bill Wilson talked about that feeling of a clear wind that was blowing through as if from the top of a mountain. And he said he supposed that God come to most men gradually, but his impact had upon him had been sudden and profound. And I stood there in that room, surrendered that morning. 27 years of daily drinking had brought me standing there totally surrendered. And from that day and to this moment, the obsession to drink was removed. It has never returned. And my miracle happened, and I've come to believe in miracles because they are real and happen to those who are unafraid to believe in them. I picked up the phone. I called a friend who was the last friend left. She's not an alcoholic. She's still my friend over 30-some years. She's an Israeli that I had met many years earlier, and she had watched me, and I said, I think I'm going to die if I don't stop drinking, and the secret was finally out. She said, I've been watching you, and I've been praying for you. She said, but there is a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and she said, call them, and they will help you. And I pick up the phone, and I call central office, and the man said, good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you? I said, man, this is, street talk man. I said, my name is Clara, and I can't stop drinking. And the secret was finally out. He said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, and don't drink today. It was like a dam burst. I just kept talking, and I really told him more than he asked for, It was like such relief. It had just been pent up in there for years and killing me. And he said, he told me where to go to a meeting that night. And my brother, I called my brother, and I hadn't had a car down there for a couple of years. I was isolated down there. My only trip was making from my house to the liquor store and the local bars. And my brother at the time was working for Delta Airlines in LAX and in Los Angeles. And I told him I needed a place, a car, because I was going to a meeting in a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought they were going to help me because I think I'd found a place for me. I never knew that there was a place for me. And he rushed over with his car, and I could still hear him running up the steps, and I was standing by the door. And he came in, and he embraced me, and he kissed me, and he said, I hope this is going to work for you. He said, because we just don't know what else to do. And we love you, and it pains us. And he gave me the keys, and that day I started to get dressed for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that I never had that experience again. I didn't know about detox, and I didn't know the language. What I have learned is the language in Alcoholics Anonymous is the language of the heart. and I was on what to wear. See, it was always important to me on looking good. And I never knew about you guys. And every fair weather friend I drank with, every single one of them's dead tonight as I stand here. Every one of them died of alcoholism, and nobody ever talked about getting sober. I didn't know people could get sober, and that's the truth. So I was I got out this red dress, and it was the only dress I had to wear, and I'd gained a lot of weight down there off of that food stamps would buy. And it was a red velvet dress, and it had wine stains on it. And I cleaned up the stains, and I got that wig out, and I cleaned it up, you know. I put her on the head farm, you know, and I combed it out, and I kind of boofed her, you know, kind of got it pumped up, sprayed it, you know. And I didn't know that my body was I started jerking, you know, and the pain, and I was like a motor, and I was walking, circling around that little dirty living room like an animal in a cage, and I thought, well, to get out of here. I went over to Woolworths around 2 o'clock that afternoon just to go browsing. And while I was browsing, I stole some eyelashes for my first meeting. And they come quite long. I didn't know you're supposed to trim them, yeah. And so, it was an 8 o'clock meeting. At 7 o'clock, I'm standing in front of the mirror. I'm all dressed. You know, I got these lashes. And they come with a little tube of glue. And so I'm trying to get the glue along the edge of the lash. And I'm standing in front of the mirror. I mean, bouncing. And waiting for an opportune moment, you know. And I slam it in, and one end was up here, and one end is down here. And I lean in the mirror, I said, "You looking good." And I went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sitting in that chair. And they started the meeting that night. The late Gail Wilson was a speaker. And I'm sitting in that chair, and I realized, you know, what had happened to me is I took a quick glimpse of my life. And alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity. And it had stripped me of all moral values that I'd certainly been taught, and all family values. And I was like a leaf in a storm. I had no place to land. And I'm sitting there bare. And they asked for the hands of the newcomer, and I didn't know what a newcomer was. And the lady behind me touched me on the shoulder and said, "Raise your hands, honey, you're a newcomer." And at the coffee break, she gave me her number, and she offered to be my sponsor that night. I was sitting on my hands in that meeting, just bouncing, perspiring. I was soaking wet. And she said, "I'll be your sponsor," and she is still my sponsor tonight. She's been my sponsor in this journey, my friend, my confidant, and my spiritual teacher. And we started this journey. We got into that book in the first 164 pages, and she did this. She insisted that I do the steps in order, 1 through 12 in that order, because I tried to pick out the ones I wanted to do. She said, "No, we don't work it that way." And so when I was 6 months sober, she called me one day and told me, "Thank God for the women in Beverly Hills," and because I was too sick to go to meetings, and they would come over and pick me up and take me to meetings. And I was going to 10, 12, 14 meetings a week for my first 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the foundation of my program, because they told me what it would take to go to meetings, to read the book, not to read between the lines. And the old timers told us all that wonderful information, to get a sponsor, to get into service. And that's what I am in today, as a result of that training from the beginning. I got sober with about 18 other newcomers that year. 3 have passed away of natural causes. The other 15 are still sober. Not one of us have ever gone out. And a lot of us are doing what I do in service, and we are an institution, and H&I work, and that has been my resolve. It didn't start that way, but that's what it evolved to. I got a job. My first job was as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress. I had no training in that kind of thing, and I had a bad, you know, I spilled a lot of coffee on people, and I had a bad attitude. And never could figure out why I couldn't get tips, you know. And I go to my home group, and I bring you greetings from my home group, the Robinson Originals, and I whined a lot. My first 2 years was spent whining. And I remember at a meeting one night, out of the back of the room came this lovely man, and he put after we'd said the Lord's Prayer, and he put his arms around me, and he said, "Clara, please, come down off the cross." He said, "We need the wood." I got on with, you know, I did, and I learned to suit up and show up and get to that job on time. It was the first time in my whole life I had learned something about self-worth. I learned to get to that job on time and do a day's work for a day's pay. I'd never known how to be that disciplined about doing anything. And when I was 2 years sober, I went back into the business that I had drank away. Today I have my own company, and I'm in property management and maintenance, because in my home, the guys in my home group, when I was about 2.5 years sober, taught me how to go out. I wanted to get out of being a waitress, and nothing wrong with that. It was just, and I'm grateful for the people who hired me. And so what I did is they showed me how to make business cards, get some business cards made. And I went into Beverly Hills on my day off from my waitress job, which was a Wednesday, and I passed out my cards in Beverly Hills, and finally a lady hired me, one of those big, huge estates. And I worked over there on my day off, and finally she passed the word around that I did good work. And you know how we are. We're just perfectionists. And she was just thrilled at the kind of work I was doing. And she got a lot of her friends. And pretty soon I had enough customers that I quit my waitress job. And today I have a rather large company. And what I do is I have contracts to the homes of the movie stars, the rich and the famous. And I have crews that go in and we do the heavy maintenance work. We maintain those, the marble floors and the chandeliers and all, and the grand things that I see. And the one thing I have learned through the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous is I don't lie and I don't steal and I don't pad the bill. And I live by these principles in all of my affairs to the best of my ability. My daughter, my little daughter that went to the ghetto with me when I was 5 years sober, was the first black professional ice skater in the Ice Capades with Dorothy Hamill. And I was in Atlanta back when I was 6 years sober, because she was at the Omni. Okay, she was skating over there, and I flew in to see her skate here. And I was just here for a short time. I made some amends. I went to the cemetery and stood in front of my parents' grave. And I had a long talk with them. And I hope that, I said to them that I hope that we will meet again. If it's in another life at another time, I hope it will be one of joy, and to forgive me for the pain I'd caused them in their lives. That younger son with the 9.5-year-old, when I was 7 years sober, we don't drink no matter what, he went into, attempted suicide. He took 150 sleeping pills. And he today is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That older son, the one who had walked out of my life, came back into my life when I was 2 years sober. And the journey in the family after my sponsor sent me to the Al-Anon program, and I'm grateful for that, because it was through that process of the Al-Anon program that I learned to be a parent to them. And that older son and I made our peace, because I did what you told me to do in that eighth and ninth step, and I made my amends to them. And I told them that I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I had been a sick person and not a bad one. And it's been a wonderful experience through these years, and I'm grateful that based on those steps that I had the opportunity to do that. And I hesitate for a moment, because I saw my son get married. He became a very successful in one of the major television networks in New York City. He's a performer, And during the early 80s, he worked there at one of those, at that particular network. And he came back to Los Angeles after 2 years after his contract ended. And he married, met Debbie and married and had a little son, and I have a little grandson. And his name is Aaron. And Aaron has never seen his grandma drunk on the floor. And when I promise to take Aaron to the park, we go to the park. Mainly we go to Toys R Us. My son died of AIDS 9 months ago. The day before the earthquake was a week from hell. God gave me a second chance. I wasn't there when he was a little boy, and I was always ashamed when I looked in his eyes. But the earth angels showed up around that bed in the form of members of Alcoholics Anonymous, the many women I sponsor, the fellowship, and experience doing what we do. We're there in the pain and we're there in the joy. And I could hold his hand and help him cross that bridge. All was forgiven, and all is well. And as I fly around the country and I'm in areas where, you know, I was in Taos, New Mexico a few weeks ago, way up there, and I could see thousands of stars. And I looked up and I know I can see my son dancing among the stars. And I'm free because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That daughter who was in Ice Capades, I offered her a partnership in my firm 3 years ago, and I'm training her, and I'm hopeful that I can retire soon, not just stop, but just retire where I have more free time to become deeper involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and service. And I was invited. I couldn't get her breakfast when she was 8 and 9 and 10 down there in that ghetto, but I was invited to the birth of their little daughter, little Nicole. They're yuppies. They live out in they live in Santa Clarita, California, and they have, you know, I don't know, they're very normal. They plan things, and they set goals. Before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know anything about that. You know, they bought the lot, they build the house, they build a pool, and then they plan the child. I never heard of such a thing, you know. But I got a call one morning on a Saturday morning that said, "Mom, it's time." And it's time to go to the hospital. And I dropped everything, and I went out to the valley, and I got in that elevator and went up in that room. And my daughter's absolutely gorgeous, and she was lying there crying. They had, you know, the Le Mans system, you know, these kids. And my son-in-law was playing tapes, and seagulls were chirping. And I looked at her, and she was, and tears were running down the side of her face. And I took some cream, and I was massaging her face and holding her hands. And we cried together, and they were not silent tears. They were tears of joy. And I went all to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just going to tell you a brief story, and then I'm going to shut up. When I was 3 years sober, I started to get well in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's very dangerous, and I like to always share that. Because, you know, all those wonderful things started to come back into my life. And I started to enjoy the gifts again and forget the giver. And I started, you know, hanging out, not going to meetings, and lying to my sponsor, and not taking the responsibility of my program and my meetings. And one afternoon, I was dancing around my house. I bought this really nice house, and I'm dancing with a broom. I'm talking about the Wynette who used to stand in front of the liquor store door, and the phone rang. And I'm listening to Billie Holiday and remembering the good old days. It's so easy to forget, you know, the bad days. when, as Dr. Silver says, when the insanity returns. And I had a call from central office, and the lady said to me, Claire, we'd like for you to make this 12-step call. And I said, I don't think I'm qualified to make a 12-step call on. I said, where is it? She said, it's down on Skid Row. I said, oh, I know I'm not qualified to go down there. I didn't even know where Skid Row was, and I was getting just a few more weeks or days, I probably would have ended up there instead of the ghetto. And she got annoyed with me. She said, oh, stop it. And I called, and she gave me the address. Her name was Dorothy, and she gave me the address of this Skid Row hotel. And I called my sponsor and to try to get out of it. And I Carol listened, fine, and she didn't say anything. I finally said, look, I don't want to do it. And she said, I don't care what you don't want to do. You do it anyway. And she hung up. And I had always heard you never go on a 12-step call alone, and this is how I got involved in the program in service. And I called this little Hollywood actress that I was sponsoring. She had about 90 days of sobriety. And I called her and I said, we're going on a 12-step call. She said, where? I said, it's down on Skid Row. She said, oh, I don't want to do that. I said, I don't care what you don't want to do. And we got in my car and we went down to Skid Row. We walked into a sleazy hotel and all the drunks were in the lobby drinking wine and beer and dancing to a transistor radio. There was no clerk around, and I found this clerk and I said, do you have somebody in here named Dorothy? And we got on this elevator, and when we went up on the third floor, and we found her at the end of the hall, and we walk into her room. And the 12th step that says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the step, we try to carry the message. And on the floor was a 21-year-old blonde young woman, just beautiful, drowning in her own vomit. And I, who had this arrogant behavior all my life, and I looked down at her, and something happened. It was like that spiritual awakening that God touched me, and somehow I was a messenger. And I'd been in this program, but I wasn't really doing those steps from my heart. I was doing it out there where I could look good to you, and something happened. And we got her up, and we cleaned her, and we took her further into Skid Row, and we got her registered. And I'm sitting across a diner at 3:00 in the morning. I'm talking about Alcoholics Anonymous from the heart. And I talked about the first step and the second step, and I talked about the third step, that we made a decision to turn our wills over to God. And she said, don't you talk to me about God. And I think I had some unresolved anger, because I stood up and reached across and grabbed her by the sweater we put on and pulled her forward. I'm going to punch her out. And Steph didn't say beat him up if he don't want it, you know. That began, it opened my eyes to this, how terrible this disease is. And I don't know what happened to Dorothy that night, but she will never know her life touching mine. She was one of those guardian, one of those earth angels that God sent to me to change the course of my life and brought me to rooms like this from my heart, to people like you. And for that, I am eternally grateful. Thank you.